This is the Australian Butchers Guild Podcast, the podcast for passionate and professional butcher shop owners.
Welcome to the Australian Butchers Guild Podcast. My name is Doug Piper. I'm the Retail Manager and Corporate Butcher for Meat and Livestock Australia. And thanks for joining us today. Keep cutting, making sausages, or just sit down and have a listen. What is the Australian Butchers Guild, or ABG? For those of you who don't know, the ABG is a membership for passionate and professional butchers who are proud to ensure the future of our trade that can continue for many years to come. The ABG first started out when a group of Queensland butchers jumped on a bus and spent a day touring different butcher shops around Queensland, visiting butchers who were willing to network and share their knowledge and success with others. The RMNC was headed up by a fellow many butchers in Australia would know called Gary McPherson and State Manager Glenn Burke. These two people were instrumental in getting the RMNC off the ground and breaking down the barriers between the butcher shop owners and raising retail standards. The RMNC facilitated tours to butcher shops all over Australia and was instrumental, along with Beef and Lamb New Zealand, in starting the Trans-Tasman Butchery Challenge, which has now grown into the World Butchery Challenge. About 6 years ago, the RMNC was rebranded as the Australian Butchers Guild. The Australian Butchers Guild still supports the independent retail butcher channel through programs like Greatest Butcher on Your Block, ABG website and social content, as well as all the beef and lamb campaign materials that you have in your shops, all available free for you to use and share on your own socials. There are approximately 3,500 independent butcher shops around Australia today, out of which approximately 2,400 that have been members of the ABG and still benefit from the campaigns and programs that MLA has created since the beginning of the RMNC days 20 odd years ago. Well, that is a brief history of the ABG, and I'm sure you'll hear more about it in the coming episodes. Part of our weekly podcast, we're going to be bringing you some news around the markets from the market information people at Meat and Livestock Australia. I'd like to introduce you to Stephen Bignell, our Market Information Manager. Steve, welcome aboard.
Thanks for having us, Doug.
Thanks, mate. Thanks for your time tonight. Mate, can you give us a little bit of a rundown what's happening around the domestic market scene, please?
I will. Today I'll talk about what's happening for the prices, both sheep and cattle, and then just touch a bit on what we're seeing in the grain-fed sector. What we're seeing at the moment in the cattle sector at the moment is record prices. We've hit some new historic highs, which we've seen at the sale yard, the price of cattle for young cattle go above $10 a kilo carcass weight for the first time ever. And the prices have really stayed there for the last around 3 weeks. So we're seeing record prices at the moment. Of that, the main buyers are no longer farmers, but actually feedlots. We've seen the feedlot sector really underpin a lot of the price and the supply this year, which is really encouraging. With the sheep market, similarly, we have seen sheep prices at the moment tick up. They are sitting above last year by 70 cents or 8%. So prices in lamb have really rebounded. They're not the highest they've been this year, but they have ticked up because we've seen smaller yardings. So we've seen less sheep hitting the sale yards, and that's resulted in higher prices for lamb at the moment. But we are starting to see new season lambs come through, Doug. So we're seeing the transition away from old season lambs into new season lambs, and we expect to see that now. We'll see that spring flush come onto the market, so we will see supply pick up, which is encouraging.
We're talking to one of the processors a few weeks ago, and he was saying he was seeing quite a few of the lovely, beautiful suckers coming through, so it's looking like a pretty good season, that's for sure.
It is, and what we're seeing now with the price rise is with the smaller yardings, it's just that transition point into the new season, and we expect that to continue. We do a survey for producers. We're expecting new season lambs to be up 35% on last year. Or we're not, but that's what the survey data says. So there'll be a lot of supply around this year, especially for lambs. And we're expecting maybe less grain-fed lambs than we've seen historically, which they've made up around 35% sometimes of lamb slaughter because of the good season. But we're really expecting high numbers to come through the sale yards. We're also seeing some interesting stuff around grain-fed cattle. In quarter one, we saw 51% of production and domestic consumption being grain-fed, and we just crunched the numbers, and we've seen that there's 17% more cattle on feed than there were in quarter one to end of June and on last year. So what we expect to see a lot more grain-fed beef coming through, and that's going to hit the butcher shops, Doug. So we're seeing domestic consumption of grain-fed beef for the first time ever over 50%, and we're going to see that flowing through butcher shops. So they'll see a far, far greater percentage of grain-fed beef, and we expect that to continue.
Terrific. So that's a bit of promising news anyway.
Yeah, very, very much so.
Great, good stuff. Thanks, Stig.
Cheers, Doug.
I'd like to introduce you to our first guest for the Australian Butchers Guild podcast, Mr. Darren O'Rourke, legend butcher from Vic's Meats and Victor Churchill's. Darren has been in the trade for a number of years and is their procurement and product specialist at Vic's Meats in Mascot.
Hello, Doug. How are you, mate? Nice to talk to you.
Yes, thanks, mate. Yeah, going well here in lockdown in Sydney, as you would be too. Yeah. So, making the most of life and... let's hope we can continue on a little bit more as per normal, a little bit down the track.
That's it.
Just want to have a little bit of a chat today about your life in the meat industry, and just we'll get the ball rolling. So how did you start out, and what made you want to become part of the meat industry?
It's a really long, drawn-out story, but to give you the very shortened version, it was towards the end of my cooking career. So I did do my chef's apprenticeship, and I was cooking for just short of 10 years there. And for a whole bunch of reasons, I got to a certain point, a massive crossroad, where I had a bit of it wasn't an epiphany, but it was certainly a questioning of my role, because I'd made it to a sous chef role. A certain night that made me question my role, my leadership abilities and whatnot, that I made the decision, or I felt I had to make a decision to either dive even deeper into the kitchen life and everything that entailed, or to take a step sideways. And that was just when Victor Churchill was rumoured to be opening and whatnot. And I applied for a job there, and it kind of, that was it. It was meant to be a year out of the kitchen to get my head right. And Victor Churchill and the Baharich family got their claws into me, and I'm there 12 years later.
Fantastic. I couldn't think of a better place to start my career at. I've always been in that shop a lot of times over the years, and I've taken many people there, and it is such a beautiful shop to visit and to see how it all works, and the history behind it is just amazing, mate.
Yeah, it's a special place, yeah, but it really is.
So, mate, what was the transition like from chef to butcher? Did you find that an easy or difficult sort of time?
Look, I wouldn't say it was difficult. And the most difficult part of it was the pressure I put on myself to learn, because I realised and I appreciated the very unique opportunity that kind of organically presented itself to me. It was meant to be a year out of the kitchen, and I just found myself drawn to the butchers and to the fresh meat case, and just wanting to pick their brains. And consequently, I was always standing next to the butcher's door there, and I just wanted to be the first one that was in their earshot if they needed something to help them to get something, run and do this, whatever it was. And it just grew from there. To one of the boys asked me to pick up a knife and cut some spatchcocks, and it kind of grew from there. So it was a really, really long, drawn-out process. And truth be told, when it was all happening, I didn't understand what was coming of it. I didn't understand that this was going to lead to something much bigger. It literally just felt like I was the guy that the butchers could yell at if they needed a bit of a help. But, you know, that was it. But it grew to something much larger, that's for sure.
Yeah, so from starting there and learning a lot about the industry, I suppose, and then on to head butcher, I imagine.
Yeah, so, I was, again, like, sort of really highlighting the very unique opportunity I had. I mean, you know, Vic was there. When we first opened Victor Churchill, you know, at one stage there was close to 150 years of collective experience with the three butchers that were there. It was Peter Shaw was one of the old butchers from Churchill's in Woollahra back before we took it over. And then, of course, we had Vic there every day. And then another dear friend of mine, Danny Woodward. I mean, three blokes that you couldn't ask for more in terms of their tenacity, their work ethic, their absolute love and joy of the industry and what they do. So it was, again, super unique and an amazing opportunity to learn under those guys. So it kind of, it was just bit by bit, but at the same time, having that chef's way of thinking, I guess, chef's mentality, and I wanted to know more. And I was amazed by the fact that I could ask Vic or Danny anything at all, and if they didn't know the answers, they never, not once did they ever lie to me. They simply said, look, Daz, I don't know. but let's find out together. So, you know, I'd like to think that they helped me massively. Of course they did. There's no questioning, but there's certainly a hell of a lot of things that together the three of us went on a journey, especially me and Danny. I worked side by side with Danny for 7 years, and we learned a lot of things together, which was amazing. Amazing to think that someone that had been in the game for 50 years was still, as I say, his love for the industry and his love for learning something different was on another level. And there was this cheeky little chef that fell into the butcher's room at the best butcher shop in the world sort of thing. And yeah, Danny didn't know what to think to start with, but yeah, he ended up certainly appreciating what I brought to the table.
Yeah, certainly a passionate fellow. And you know, you never stop learning, yeah. Do you? Like, that's one thing I've learned. You know, you think you know everything. Like, as I say to some guys, you know, I bought my first butcher shop at the age of 23 when I knew everything, and I haven't stopped learning since. So you can never know enough, and there's always something changing, something different happening, or some new piece of equipment or technology that's coming onto the scene that's going to make life a little bit easier. So, absolutely. You know, you've got to keep your eyes open and ears open as well at the same time.
I wasn't satisfied with just understanding. Of course, I needed to know the basics, the foundations. Of course, anyone worth their weight needs to understand that and be skilled at it. But I just wanted more. I wanted to know about all of these different cuts. I wanted to know, you know, the difference between an inside and outside and a thick skirt. I wanted to know the difference between the two bavettes. That was the thing that sort of kept me going. And I think in the early days for me anyway, that was looking at the craft of butchery and looking at something that, I mean, look, the animal's the same every single time. It's broken the same every single time. Like, very little changes when you look at it that way. And it's so easy to get, I don't know, to get blasé, to get a little bit bored, I guess. But I think that's where it all started for me was saying, you know what, for something that is very regimented, there is still so much to learn. And seeing that Danny and Vic were really open to learning these new things that even they didn't know was, I think that was what lit that spark and sort of really made me understand that, you know what, this, no one's ever going to know everything about this industry, about this trade.
Yeah, definitely. I agree with you 100% there, mate.
Yeah.
So when I've been into to Victor Churchill's, the way that the meat's displayed is something completely different to what you'd see in a normal butcher shop, with the upright fridges and the marble and everything that goes on in there. But it's one thing that strikes me, and a few butchers are doing it well, and it's branding. You know, beef and lamb branding, so important. And so how important it is for butchers? Like, we know, but what's your thoughts on it? How important is it to understand what you're selling today?
I think it's imperative. I don't know a single... I mean, look, at the end of the day, not only are we tradesmen, not only are we craftsmen and women, we're also salespeople. Like, you know, we're selling... It's not just a product you're selling. It's an idea. It's an ethos. It's a set of morals and ethics that you're selling. And I don't know any salesperson under the sun that doesn't understand everything about the product they're selling. So why on earth shouldn't we? If you're talking about provenance, if you're talking about the feeding regime, if you're talking about the age of the animal, I mean, you and I and everyone else in the game know full well that all of those factors greatly determine the end product. With not necessarily positively or negative, just negatively, just it's different. And I think it's completely and utterly wrong to not understand those things. If you're selling these products, it's your responsibility. People are trusting you to buy something that you've prepared and put it into their bodies to nourish them. The absolute least you can do as the person that's preparing that for them and making that transaction is to understand exactly what it is you're giving them.
There's obviously a lot of work goes in behind the scenes in some butcher shops, in particularly where you've come from, you know, in the training aspect and training people and giving them that knowledge. Because, you know, to be able to go somewhere and ask a question and they give you the correct answer is so reassuring and gives you so much satisfaction that, you know, people out there are so passionate about what they're selling and you know, it just gives you so much comfort in knowing that.
It does. And it goes both ways. I mean, any customer that gets that information from you is, the satisfaction is for them, but it's, as I say, it goes both ways. The satisfaction for you is the person that got that information and then delivered that face to face to someone that's trusting you with it is, it drives you. It really does. I don't know a butcher at all that doesn't sort of take that gratitude from a customer because of what they've done and not inspire them to not only continue to do it, but to do it better every single time.
Yeah. Mate, one of the other things that I've got to ask you about, retired dairy cattle. I see it on your Instagram posts a lot. So how did you come across those types of cattle and how palatable are they?
Well, that was, I mean, I'd sort of certainly read about them and seen about that sort of stuff, especially in the north of Spain and in Scandinavia and that sort of thing. And I'd been working with Luke and Jess Michaela for Camden Valley Farm for 6 or 7 years now, I think. And it started out that we were just buying veal carcasses off them. Now, what they were doing, you know, Luke and Jess are both sort of dairy farmers and from dairy farming backgrounds. But Luke saw not to speak on his behalf, but he certainly saw, I guess, danger, for want of a better word, in the future of the dairy industry as a whole. He wanted to sort of sidestep and start doing what he could to rescue these bull calves from the surrounding farms and feed them from his herd and sort of see if he could sell them on as an ethically raised veal product, which we all know in this country is a massively misunderstood sort of product in itself, underrated and misunderstood. Misunderstood most importantly by the fact that so many people just do not draw the parallel between the dairy industry and veal, right? But yeah, so we were getting veal carcasses off them probably once a fortnight. And then as Luke and our relationship grew, sort of conversations were always back and forth about old dairy cows and what does he do with them and this and that. And yeah, we decided just to try one once and see how it went. And the very first one was, although we both did it with very little knowledge up our sleeves, it was good enough to want us to inspire us to do it again. Second time round was even better, and it's just grown from there. So look, I wouldn't be lying if I said it's certainly some of my favorite beef. In terms of flavor, the depth of flavor, I wouldn't say it's unparalleled, but it's on a different level to what I think we're all used to, you know, from a 24, 36 month old cattle, whatever. Texturally, look, I rate it. I think if the animal's been retired properly, if it's been cared for properly, if it's come from good bloodlines and whatnot, and if they're given the adequate time to retire and recondition properly, I question anyone that says that it's tough. I really don't think it is. But on top of that, what I question even more is people's perception of toughness, or let's not call it toughness, texture, of texture being a yardstick, for want of a better word, of quality. I think too many people think that if it's tender, it's good quality. And a lot of people don't really understand that meat doesn't have to be tender. We've got teeth for a reason. And if you procure these animals the right way, if you age them correctly, if they need it, and then it goes over to the cook or the chef, and certainly to the butcher to convey this knowledge, if you cook it the correct way, it's... Look, I think it's amazing beef. Yeah, I really do.
I haven't yet tried it yet, but I'll definitely be sinking my choppers into something like that one of these days.
I'll save you something off the next one. There's a few more,
mate,
on the way.
Beautiful. And that brings me to, you know, you mentioned about the meat being a little bit chewier, like secondary cuts. So, you know, we often find that, you know, some of those secondary cuts that are out there, a couple of them eat extremely well, and others eat extremely well being cooked a specific way. You know, every cut has its own different cooking method. So what's your favourite secondary cut, mate? What's your secret little cut that you have?
It changes. It changes a lot. I think at the moment, just because I cut some just recently off the last lot of Wagyu that we had through the place, was a cut called the Velvet Steak, which a lot of people know about. It was, you know, it was a lot of people in the States, a lot of butchers in the States were cutting this many years ago. And I know it's filtered through to a lot of butchers in Australia. Merlot steak is the other name for it. I like velvet for some reason. I don't like the word Merlot steak for some reason. But that's just taken out of the heel muscle. So it's, as anyone would know, that when you pull that heel muscle out, which would predominantly get diced or, you know, braised, ground, whatever, there's that one individual muscle there that it almost looks kind of flank-like in shape and the fibrous nature of it. But it eats like butter. Here's me saying, you know, tenderness isn't always a pinpointing, you know, a yardstick for quality, but it eats like butter. But the flavour, coming from a muscle that's sitting there, load-bearing, doing a lot of work, it's an absolute cracking steak.
Yeah, we did a little thing on that a little while ago through the Australian Butchers Guild. We did a little video on that, one of the how-to videos that we do. And we sort of pulled the heel muscle apart there, and it's amazing. You know, you've got the two, once you pull the Achilles tendon out, once you pull that tendon out, you've got the two muscles either side of that bit of silver skin, how different the two can eat. One is far superior than the other, but I agree. It is a really lovely piece of beef. Lovely piece of beef, yeah. So, you know, rather than grinding it, look at something different. That's something different butchers can put in their shops, you know, that not everybody has.
And I think it's one of the things that might sort of discourage butchers from looking into those sorts of things. They might be sort of, yeah, I mean, I certainly don't know a lot of butchers that still get whole bodies of beef. I mean, I know Brett Laws down there at Pride still gets them, as we see him busting them down every Monday. But I mean, look, even if you did only get one body of beef every now and then, you can still put two of them in the case, sort of thing. Someone is going to take them, and it's a conversation starter. You write that tag to put into that piece of meat. You write the breed, where it was from, all of that sort of stuff. So it goes back to that information and conveying that information. People are going to ask questions. Now, I'd actually prefer if they sat in the case there for a whole day, because if they're in there all day, there's a whole bunch of people that are going to look at it. They might ask the question what it is. They might not ask the question, but I guarantee you that everyone's going to look past it and read it and go, what the hell's that? You're starting that conversation. You're starting people thinking a little bit sort of sideways without even knowing it. And I think there's great value in that.
Oh, definitely, definitely. You know, like everything's available in carton form anyway, you know, so even if you're not buying in carcasses, you can still buy cartons of them. And at the end of the day, if they don't sell them, it's still a no-lose situation.
That's
good mince.
You take the extra couple of seconds to seam it out there and clean it up and put it in there, start that conversation, maybe sell it, maybe not, whatever. As you say, if it doesn't sell, put it where you were going to put it in the first place anyway.
Also getting on to, I suppose, the transition from being on the knives, like I went through it quite a few years ago from being, you know, on the knives every day, you know, 6 days, 7 days a week, to being off the knives in my current role. So how have you found that transition of doing that? I know you said earlier that you were on the knives for most of today.
Yeah. Again, touching on that whole thing of, you know, I always say forever a student, but like it got to that point where I vividly remember there was a day just going through the Christmas madness. So not only was it the usual somewhat subdued Christmas madness last year during COVID, but it was also the first Christmas that we had done as a business with this online platform. And I was standing there on a block, you know, I had Vic on one side of me and I had a guy named Lawrence Wong on the other side of me. Now, Laurie, I think he's 66 or 67 or something, but Laurie is the first employee of Vic's Meat. So he started with Vic's Meat over 25 years ago. His employee number it's not 001 because that's Anthony and Vic, but Laurie's number 3. But anyway, I mean, these are two guys that I draw massive amounts of inspiration from. But I remember in the middle of this carnage, just looking to my left and seeing Vic and looking to my right and seeing Laurie. And I just thought, I love both of these guys and I love both of why they're here doing it, but do I want to be dragging a knife at 65, 70 years of age? And you know what? If I have to, I happily will. But it just made me think, hang on, it's time for another sidestep. It's time to start and use what's up here a little bit more and try and learn something different. So that was what prompted the move upstairs to the office. But I'm lucky. I'm still on the knives every day for at least a little bit of time. It's very much a Swiss Army knife roll. The knives mightn't be the sharpest, but there are multiple knives in my little kit at the minute for different places in the building. It's interesting. It's never a dull moment, that's for sure.
it's a skill that you can take with you anywhere, and you know, and it's a passion too that you show for the industry and for the trade, which probably brings us to the next question, mate. Butchers. Where are they? They're so hard to find. Yeah. You know, if I had a couple of dozen butchers in my back pocket, I reckon I could get them all have jobs tomorrow. You know, one of the things I talk to a lot of butchers about when they ring me saying, "Do you know where I can get a butcher from?" I say, "Have you thought about putting on a chef?" You know, to me, it's a bit of a no-brainer. If you're really struggling out there, why not put on a chef? So, you know, chefs can bring all sorts of skills. Anything in particular that you can think of off the top of your head?
Whether you're a butcher or a chef, you're both running towards the same end goal. The butcher is preparing the raw ingredient and the chef or the cook is finishing it off for, you know, whether it's for a customer in a restaurant or whatever. But you've got a, we've both got a shared goal, a common goal, but we both see things very, very differently. You know, a chef can look at what a butcher does and ask questions, you know, why. It's not to say that they're going to highlight things that a butcher might be doing wrong, because that just doesn't really make sense. Chef's not going to walk into someone that's been on the knives for that long and pick up where they're doing things wrong, but they are just going to ask questions. And it goes back to this whole learning thing. If you stop asking questions, or if anyone stops asking questions of you, you're destined to a career of just monotony. So I don't see anything other than value in at least in entertaining the idea of getting a chef on the block, or vice versa. Well, there are no butchers out there, as we know anyway, and certainly not many kitchen roles going at the minute. But, I mean, that's the thing. At this point in time, there's loads of chefs that I think would absolutely jump at the opportunity to get on the block and have a crack.
And, you know, they've got knife skills. They've got a bit of meat knowledge there. They know the difference between a slice of rump and a slice of topside or sirloin or whatever, you know. But it's that, what I've seen, they teach, they bring so much to the plate, you know. They, like you explained, they can talk about the cooking method. They can talk about doing different types of value adding that is so hot at the moment in butcher shops. There's just so many opportunities there. And, you know, mate, if I was looking for a butcher and couldn't find one, that'd be my first port of call.
Absolutely. And I think it starts with being able to hold a knife. And that's the one thing that if you cut both of our trades down to its bare nuts and bolts, the one thing that both of us can do identically to each other is hold a knife. And that's where it starts to be a butcher. So, I mean, chefs are already a long way. And funnily enough, it was that exact point that Danny and Vic made to me back in the beginning at Victor Churchill when I first picked up a knife and they saw, you know, that I could actually hold a knife. There's, all right, maybe you can do a thing or two. We'll just show you a few things here and there. But that's what gave them the confidence from the very beginning to at least give me a shot.
Yeah, mate. Well done, mate. You've done a great job there. And I'm sure both Anthony and Vic are very proud to have you on board and are grateful to have you there as well, mate. And you're a great person to have in the industry. So mate, we're going to roll it up there. We've got a little bit more to do today, but look, mate, thanks a lot for taking the time out and sharing your journey with us all, and we'll look forward to catching up with you in the not so distant future.
Pleasure.
Now I'd like to introduce Stuart Fuller, General Manager for Retail Business for AMIC. Stuart, welcome aboard.
Thank you, Doug. Nice to be with you.
Thanks for coming, mate. And let's get on with what's happening in the Sausage King world. You've got a little bit of news about that.
The Sausage King program is up and running, Doug. It's been running this year. Obviously, a fantastic response from all the independent local butchers. It's been a great opportunity to compete across the regions for the independents to promote their business, their products, and really raise the profile of their local business. Whether it's traditional Australian beef, pork, poultry, continental sausages or burgers or small goods, there's a category which we believe is for everyone and anyone. There's been some amazing flavours come through this year, and we're amazed every year in terms of the output that the guys can produce across regional and metro cities. It really does get our butchers excited on the ground in terms of showcasing their flavour combinations. You know, you've got lamb, apricot, macadamia, lemon, lime, chili, coriander, beef and beetroot, you name it, celery, ginger, garlic. We've run 26 regional competitions to date. We've got 11 more to go for the remainder of this year, and it's been really hotly contested. But it's a fantastic program, and it's really boding well with the members out there.
Yeah, it's a great program for the butchers to display what they can do with their sausages. Like it's no longer just a plain barbecue sausage or a thin sausage or you know some butchers have anywhere from a dozen to a couple of dozen different flavors on the go all the time. You know, I've judged a couple of the events over the years, and you just see the standards growing and getting better and better, and it's a great tool for the butchers to have to advertise themselves to the public.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a lot of them have been very excited. And again, as we've mentioned there, they get to showcase some new flavour combinations. And again, they can show those off to their customers. And it really resonates well with their customers. And they get some great feedback as well from their customer base to let them know that their combinations with their flavours are going really well. So, yeah, it's a really good program. And yeah, I've been amazed in terms of, as I say, the different combinations and styles and varieties which have come through this year.
And I know that we also run the Apprentice of the Year competition alongside the national finals. So that's coming up as well. That's all going ahead.
Yeah, so we're excited. We've obviously got the return of the Apprentice of the Year competition. We encourage all first, second and third year apprentices to enter. So if any of the guys listening have got apprentices who they work with, it's really a great opportunity for the apprentices to test their skills and go head to head with other apprentices in their state. The first state competition kicks off in South Australia on the 25th of August, and that's followed after that on the 1st of September with the Queensland state competition. The other states will roll in after that, pending COVID restrictions. But it really is a fantastic opportunity for the guys to showcase their skills, and there's always a keen interest each year. With the guys going head to head, not only in their state but then at that national level to see where they measure up.
Yes, I've seen a few of the apprentices come through over the years that have been through the competition, and you know the work and the standards that they have. You know, they're very, very talented young people, both you know, females and males that are in the trade. And I think a lot of the girls that are in there, they're going so well. Like they just bring that little bit of extra finesse when they're doing their work, don't they? You can see it in the quality of the work that they produce.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we both know that at the heart of it, butchery is a trade. And obviously, if they can showcase their skills, cutting, preparing meat, it's obviously years of training and experience across the board. And a lot of these guys have only got 1 or 2 years experience under their belt. But it's, again, getting that knowledge base, getting a bit more information from other people around the room, looking at mentors, et cetera, so it's, yeah, it really does. It's a great program that a lot of the young people can really go into.
Yeah, I suppose, and that also, how do we get people into the trade? That's all young ones into the trade. I think that's another program that AMIC has at the moment, that I think a lot of butchers are benefiting from, the PATH program.
Yeah, absolutely. So AMIC's, our HR and IR team are working, they're continuing on working with the Federal Department of Education Skills and Employment on the PATH Business Partnership Program. It's a concept proposal that they're working through at the moment, which outlines the meat industry's plan to address and identify workforce needs and pathways specifically for young people aged 17 to 24. Looking for employment in the meat industry. So there's a pilot program which is running at the moment in Victoria and New South Wales, and then we've got a national rollout planned over the remainder of this year and into next year. But it's a great initiative and program which will hopefully aid in career opportunities not only in the retail independent butcher sector, but then also across the other sectors as well, be it small goods and processing. So there are many and varied career opportunities within the meat industry, so it's just opening up those pathways and doors to hopefully there is an opportunity for a lot more down the track.
Yeah, that's great, mate. Yeah, I was talking to Darren O'Rourke earlier, and you know, expressing how, you know, the state of the nation when it comes to butchers, to try and, butchers are screaming for tradespeople out there, and you know, there's a lot of opportunities within the meat industry, as what the PATH program points out. You know, you don't have to stay on the tools for the whole of your career. There's other opportunities out there where you can go. So, yeah, definitely a great program to have, mate.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think in general as well, from that perspective, it's from an independent local butcher perspective, again, it's around providing personalised service to local customers. It's passing on your knowledge and advice, be it recipe ideas, meal inspiration tips. The butcher's always that community focused, respected and trusted. They're obviously knowledgeable about farm gate to plate. They care very much about their communities and small business. So there's a lot of scope for them to work across multiple aspects within their business. But then there's also a lot to do within the other sectors as well, and opportunities, be it in processing or small goods.
And finally, mate, state dinners, are they going to go ahead? We hope.
We're very, very hopeful. Obviously, Queensland, South Australia and Western Australia seem to be in a very good position at the moment. So, yeah, they really are a great chance to come together and celebrate as a network within the meat industry. We welcome all sectors, including retail, small goods, and also processing and industry partners to come along and have a great night. But if you jump on our website, amic.org.au, there's ticket details and venues details there. And it pretty much just is a celebration of the Sausage King events that we've run. It's a celebration of the Apprentice of the Year. It's a celebration of the Retailer of the Year and all things that are happening within the industry. But we're hopefully going to finalise some dates and venues for New South Wales, Victoria and Tasmania. But at the moment, the other states are a full tilt, hopefully, with those state dinners going ahead. Yeah. COVID-free.
Terrific. Yeah, that'll be good to see. Then we'll get off and running and celebrate the butchery trade.
Absolutely.
Well, Stuart, thanks a lot for coming along tonight. Appreciate the news that you've got for us, and we'll look forward to catching up with yourself or one of the other field team over the next few weeks.
You're welcome. Sounds good. Thank you so much, Doug.
Thanks for listening to the Australian Butchers Guild podcast. Episode 2 is going to be coming out soon, but if you'd like to be involved or would like to have a say about what's going on around the community or in your butcher shop, please contact us at butchers@mla.com.au.
You've been listening to the Australian Butchers Guild podcast, produced by The Sound Business.